Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Before the Apollo astronauts went to the moon and brought back hundreds of pounds of rocks for analysis, theories on the origin of the moon fell into three basic camps. The so-called fission theory said that the moon somehow spun out of the early molten Earth. The capture theory posited that the moon was a wandering protoplanet, captured by the Earth's gravity. Finally, there was the idea that they formed together somehow. Then came the giant impact hypothesis that explained the formation of the moon by a Mars-sized object striking the early Earth and spinning off a ring of debris, forming the moon. And while it's a satisfying idea, in many respects, it has an underlying flaw. The moon should be made of material from the impacting body, and therefore different from Earth. But the lunar samples tell another story. To resolve the mystery of the moon rock's similarity to those of the Earth, which they most certainly are, our guests have developed a new twist on the impact theory. Sarah Stewart is a MacArthur Award-winning planetary scientist from UC Davis and has worked closely with a team including postdoctoral researcher Simon Locke from the California Institute of Technology. Both joined us to talk about their latest ideas on the formation of the Earth-Moon system. Sarah Stewart and Simon Locke, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Well, I'd like to start out, if we could, going back to back when I was a kid in the 1960s and what the ideas were for how our moon came to be. As I recall, there was the fission theory, and I remember this idea was people would look at the Earth in the giant Pacific Ocean basin and say, well, the moon may have come out of that. And actually just like blopped somehow out of the Earth and then shot out into its orbit. And then there was the idea that perhaps it was some kind of an asteroid type object that got captured by Earth's gravity. Or the other idea was that it just formed in the same region of space at the same time. It accreted and formed together with the Earth. And those were the three ideas that I remember hearing about when Project Apollo was going on. Is that about right?
Yes, those were the pre-Apollo ideas, and all three of them were proven wrong by that mission.
Anything you want to add to that, Simon?
Yeah, so basically it was found that either those ideas didn't match the data or proved to be an incredibly unlikely event to explain a system like the Earth and the Moon. For example, the probability of capturing into orbit a lunar-sized body flying past the Earth and ending up on its present orbit is very unlikely.
And the measurements of the Moon show that the Moon had a very small iron core. So even if the Moon could be captured, you couldn't explain why its core was so small.
Yeah, and you know, knowing what we now know about plate tectonics in the Pacific Ocean basin, you know, that's all quite silly too. So, but I just remember those were the ideas before we went to the moon with Project Apollo. So, what I'd really like you to explain to us is how did those missions and the rocks that the astronauts brought back, how did they lead us to this idea of the impact hypothesis? What was it about those rocks that got us thinking in a different direction?
So one of the big observations or sort of conclusions that was that came out of the Apollo missions was that the moon had to have started its life significantly molten. It must have had what we call a magma ocean. So that's where the surface of the planet at some point was completely molten rock. And this was found because a lot of the rocks that came back from the moon were anorthosite. And these are sort of pure plagioclase, which is a silicate mineral. And it was found that those sort of rocks only really form when crystallizing sort of a magma ocean. You end up with those crystals end up floating to the top of that magma ocean and forming a crust, which is what the sort of the light patches that we observe on the moon today are made out of. And so it was that conclusion, I think, combined with really a change in thinking about how planets were formed. So around the time of the Apollo missions, some new thinking had arisen that basically planets, instead of slowly accumulating from sort of dust or spontaneously springing into being, they actually formed by the collisions of smaller things that sort of slowly grew into bigger things, and then those bigger things collided together. And so the idea of planets colliding was sort of an idea that was gaining ground in sort of the theoretical understanding of planet formation. And it took sort of two groups independently, sort of put two and two together and thought maybe we could make the moon by one of these giant collisions.
Let me just add a comment. You've got to imagine the state of science at the time, where all of the previous theories have been thrown out the window. And scientists had to start from scratch with the Apollo data. So they were really looking around for new ideas. And the fact that a Russian astronomer named Safronov had been doing the most advanced calculations of planet formation at the same time that showed that large bodies could collide was just an amazing alignment of information that everyone needed at the time to propose a giant impact.
So as I recall, I remember seeing a lot with an astronomer, an American astronomer named William Hartman, who was a proponent or an advocate of the giant impact theory. Can you talk a little bit about his role?
Bill Hartman had a history of studying impact cratering on the moon. And so he understood the process very well, that material would be thrown outward and could even escape the planet that the crater was formed on. And so when he had heard of this work that showed that really large bodies could collide, he proposed an impact ejecta origin for the moon, which he is credited for the giant impact idea. But he actually thought it could have been multiple events, that it didn't have to be one. And so he described it as an impact-triggered origin without being very specific about the details, whereas an independent group with Al Cameron and Bill Ward proposed a single Mars-sized object because they could explain the length of day of the Earth with that type of collision.
And this makes me think of when, if I read, for example, an earth science textbook about the origin of the moon, you'll get the basic steps that happened, that this Mars-sized object, which is called often Theia, impacted the Earth, tore off a significant hunk of the Earth's crust and mantle, and that went into orbit around the Earth and formed the moon. I'd like to know how you, Sarah, especially, and Simon, how you guys got interested in your investigations of this problem of the origin of the moon.
So when I was going to conferences as a young professor, there were these great debates going on about the origin of the moon because the Mars-sized impactor idea predicted that the moon would form primarily from the body that hit us. But the geochemists were finding more and more evidence that the moon is sort of a twin to the Earth in the ratio of many different elements. So these different isotopes of elements can be measured very precisely. And the moon ended up being identical to the Earth in multiple elements. And the geochemists were advocating that the moon has to come from the Earth. And the physicists were saying, no, our calculations don't show that. The moon has to come from the other body. We have to figure out a way of reconciling the two. And so at the time, I just knew there was this big problem. And I had a postdoc who was interested in working on it, who also wanted to explain the orbit of the moon. His name is Matija Chuk. And so he got me to work on it. That's how I started, was his instigation. And that led us to proposing a high angular momentum, high spin origin of the Earth that did not match the length of the day, but could make a disk that looked like the Earth, and that could explain the chemistry. And so that was my first foray into the origin of the moon.
And about when was that?
That was published in a 2012 paper, and it opened the door to considering different length of day, so faster spinning Earth after moon formation, because Matia came up with a way of changing the length of day after we make the moon.
Ah. And Simon, what about you?
Well, so I started grad school in 2012, sort of conveniently on the back of the publication of Sarah's paper. And actually, it was one of the first papers Sarah sent me to read before I started grad school. It's like, oh, yeah, here's a collection of papers. But really, it was in some ways sort of by accident. So my original PhD thesis was going to be looking at how planets gained and lost their atmospheres. But Sarah and I were sort of sitting in her office. I believe we were trying to write a grant proposal at the time. And we were looking at some of the outputs from Sarah's simulations, and we're just trying to figure out what was happening, what was being formed in these collisions. And it didn't look like we had been told it would look like. It didn't look like it was a planet surrounded by a disk. It looked like something very different. And that, trying to answer that question of what is it that we're seeing and what the impact of that was for moon formation, sent me and Sarah and certainly my PhD thesis down a completely different track.
And Sarah, I'd like to ask you, you are famously a MacArthur grant winner, the so-called genius grant. Was that because of your work on this?
Certainly, the moon work from the beginning with Matia and definitely with Simon's discoveries was a major factor in my recognition for that award.
And I've gotten the great joy of being able to talk to a few MacArthur grant winners, and that they're all just amazing people. And I would like to know, what was it like for you when you first found out? Because it always seems to be kind of a mysterious process where it's just kind of this bolt out of the blue.
It was a bolt out of the blue because I had no inkling in that there was no whispering nearby that I had heard that I was even being considered. I was literally in my office, and often I screen my phone calls, but there was a phone call from a Chicago area code, and I thought, oh, I know people in Chicago, I'll pick that up. And a woman introduced herself and said that she was from the MacArthur Foundation, and had I heard of the fellowship program? And I sort of fell out of my chair and said, of course I've heard of this. I can't believe you're calling me. So it was a beautiful surprise. And the irony of the whole thing is afterwards I found out that Simon knew that I had been considered before I knew anything because they had asked him about me. And so unbeknownst to me, several people around me knew that I was in the running and were very good at keeping the secret.
Oh, wow. That's quite stealthy, Simon.
it was very hard. It was very entertaining, though, when I got the phone call from Sarah, sort of like very, very excited. And I was like, I wonder.
Aw. And wow, that must have been a real thrill for you, too, then.
Oh, it's such a fantastic thing. It's sort of, Sarah is such a wonderful person, has been such a great source of inspiration and advice to me. It was sort of very nice to see her recognized for that. And also I get to tell people that, you know, Sarah's work with me sort of got her a MacArthur Award, which is a really gratifying thing.
Oh, certainly. And how has the award helped you for both of you in your work on the giant impact hypothesis?
So I think the biggest outcome is that it's really raised the awareness of this new object that we discovered, a synestia, and let us distribute this information to the public, as we're doing now, that there is still a lot to be discovered in planetary science. And one of the newest discoveries relates to why Earth is the way it is.
And it is one of the wonderful things when I talk to people and they mention synestias and moon formation and they have no idea who I am. I'm just like, this is great. They found out about this through the news or through some sort of popular science website, and they found out independently of sort of knowing about the research. And so it's sort of great to really have that in the public consciousness, which is fantastic.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about the formation of the moon with Sarah Stewart and Simon Locke. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our conversation on the formation of the moon with Dr. Sarah Stewart from UC Davis and Simon Locke from the California Institute of Technology. I'd like to know your latest thoughts and our latest understanding about the formation of the moon, you know, and kind of in the complete picture that you can paint for us. But could you tell us a bit about the methodology that you use? How do you go about modeling and studying this? Is it mostly with computer models, or I believe you do some actual like physical physics testing of some of this too, don't you?
I do experiments and modeling, and most of the work that went into the new moon idea is based on modeling, but I think we only figured out what was happening because I also did experiments and thought deeply about what was really happening to the materials when they got hit at such high velocities. So I think we needed both sides. And Simon can tell you about what he had to develop in order to understand. We had to invent new ways of looking at the data, new kinds of plots, just to explain it to other scientists. And that took a lot of back and forth between us.
Very much so. Lots of days spent in Sarah's office banging her head against a wall with a whiteboard trying to work out what we were looking at. But yeah, I think it's one of the real joys of working in planetary science, and certainly doing a lot of what I and Sarah do, is that we're connecting so many different pieces and so many different fields that normally are quite separate. So in order to address the origin of the moon, we had to combine everything from some shock physics experiments to sort of big fluid dynamic simulations to very complex thermodynamic calculations and sort of every little bit of the process, because these things are happening over such huge scales. You have to combine the large scale of the impact itself with what's happening really at the sort of the micro scale, sort of the what's happening to little droplets of silicate in this big vapor cloud that's produced by the impact. And what's happening at that micro scale is really dictating what you're finding out. So you have to care about the chemistry of the interactions, the fluid dynamics of what's happening at those surfaces. And combining that all together was really one of the big challenges of answering this sort of question, is that you have to be fluent in the language of all of those different things, even if you have your friend to actually do the sort of hardcore calculation.
But what's new that we can do today that our predecessors didn't have is we can recreate a giant impact in the lab. And there are now a couple different large-scale facilities owned by the Department of Energy that have basic science programs where you can reach the high pressures that are generated in a giant impact and study what happens to the material. And so for several years now, I've been involved in a program with the Sandia National Labs Z machine, which is a giant capacitor that can launch metal plates up to 40 kilometers per second, right, which is how fast the Earth is going around the sun, and study what happens. And so that capability really pushed us to thinking about the details of the event in a much deeper way than anyone had been able to do before.
And when you first did one of these experiments, and I'd like to really describe what that's like, because that is what fascinated me when I first heard about your work, was like, wow, this really sounds like an interesting combination of not just computer modeling and theoretical work, but you're also doing this physical experiment where you're getting to see what happens. And I found that awesome. That's what, to me, real science should always be about, is experiment backing up the theoretical ideas in a lab setting. And I found that to be just wonderful. Could you tell us, was there like an aha moment when you first did one of these experiments where you're like, and this started to lead you down this new path?
There is an aha moment that led to understanding how materials vaporize in giant impacts. And that led to the other aha moment that Simon described earlier, that said we really don't understand what forms after a giant impact. So the aha moment in the lab, I have what's called a gas gun. It's literally a cannon. And you place your target at the muzzle. It's usually a mineral that we're trying to study, like a mineral in the mantle, or my early experiments were on ice, and fire a metal plate at it with the cannon that's launched by gunpowder. And we measured the temperature, how hot it got when it was shocked, and then we measured the temperature of how much it cooled down as it decompressed back into the target tank. And what I found was that the temperatures as it cooled down didn't make any sense. And when I had my eureka moment was me realizing that second temperature, the colder temperature, actually told me where the material was vaporizing and gave me that point in space so that I could understand how much vapor was being produced. And I did those first experiments in my gun lab at Harvard at the time. And then when we first applied to use the Z machine, I took some of my advisor's old data and reinterpreted it and realized he saw the same thing in rocks. He had data on quartz. And that led us to propose what's now been a longstanding campaign to measure the vaporization of minerals in the mantle, like olivine, and metals like iron, that are the main building blocks of planets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you describe for us what, because I'm trying to picture this, and it, for students, I know they love things that blow up and explosions and stuff like that. This sounds pretty awesome. Can you describe to us physically what this apparatus at Sandia looks like, how big it is, and what kind of energy is involved?
So it is a huge capacitor. It's called a pulsed power machine. So you charge it up, all these capacitors that store energy. And the amazing thing about the Z machine is that you can release that energy defining the profile of the release so that you can drive it into a metal plate and through a magnetic force launch metal plates to planetary velocities. The escape velocity from the Earth is 11 kilometers per second. You can get to several escape velocities. So that energy is discharged and launches a plate that instigates an experiment that lasts 100 nanoseconds. And all of the data is taken in real time on very fast digitizers. And then the whole thing blows up. And so the experiment itself is in this big black pit, this rectangular pit that's the circular pit in the middle of the Z machine. And when the whole thing discharges, there's an electromagnetic pulse that goes into the building and there's a little shake. And then everyone's watching the digitizers to see that the data is successfully acquired. So it's sort of weeks of preparation followed by what to you feels like a second of terror as you cross your fingers and hope that all the data are okay.
Wow.
there is a wonderful picture of that is the, I believe, only picture that's been taken inside the Z machine when it's discharged. And you can see, you sort of gives you an idea of the huge electrical power that's being released in that experiment.
It's called arcs and sparks because there's little lightning bolts that are going across the capacitors. And the power that's discharged in these experiments is enough to temporarily power a small town. They really are high energy experiments that mimic the high energy of planet formation.
Wow. Oh, that's and I love to see that picture. If you could send me a link later to that, I would like to see that.
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Okay. So, you know, one of the things I'd like to get from you is, and before we do that, let's talk about, you know, I don't think most people realize what an oddity the Earth-Moon system is in the solar system. Because, you know, when you look at the inner planets, the so-called terrestrial planets of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, they don't have moons. You know, Mercury's got these, or Mars rather, has these two little captured asteroid, lumpy potato rock things, Phobos and Deimos. But the Earth has this, is really a double planet system. It really is kind of an oddity in the solar system, isn't it?
Simon, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, absolutely. It is the mass ratio between the moon and Earth is sort of 1 to 100. So the moon is 1% the mass of the Earth. That might not sound very much, but it is a huge size for a satellite. And really, apart from things that are sort of minor planet size, things like Pluto and some asteroids, no other planet in our system has a companion that is that big. And it is possible that maybe Venus had such a companion, but lost it in the very early days of its existence. But really, we have no other examples of such an extraordinary system.
And the moon's terribly important for regulating so many things about the Earth, too, isn't it? Could you just talk a little bit about that?
So the moon is very helpful, sort of normally considered as a sort of stabilizing effect on the Earth's obliquity. So it sort of stops the Earth's rotation axis from wobbling all over the place, which helps give us a very consistent and stable climate over hundreds of millions of years. It also is probably very important for controlling how long our day is. Because if you had not formed the moon, or at least if you had had the giant impact and not formed the moon, we would have still at the present day a day that would last less than 5 hours. So our 24-hour day is really due to the fact that the moon over time has moved away from the Earth, slowing Earth's rotation and really controlling the sort of lovely day, 24-hour day we have now.
Which also makes me think about, you know, our twin as far as size and density, Venus. It has a really strangely long rotation rate.
Exactly. And that still is a very big mystery as to why the moon and Earth have so much what we call angular momentum, sort of spin inertia, and why this Earth suddenly very early on spun so fast, whereas Venus seems to have basically, from the processes that we know of, if it never formed a moon, it kind of only ever had a day as fast as about 12 hours, and that something is very different between those two planets. And what that is still a topic of strong debate.
Well, yeah, because now its rotation rate is like, isn't it longer than its orbit around the sun?
Now you're testing my memory of orbital parameters.
Yeah, it has an insanely long rotation rate that's, you know, measured in days, not hours. But anyway, it's just interesting to me how important our moon is to us and how unique the Earth-Moon system is compared to, you know, other satellites. Another thing I'd like to ask you guys about is, We have the data from the Apollo reflectors, the laser ranging experiment on the moon, where we left the reflectors at the Apollo landing sites and bounced the lasers off them to measure the distance. And we know that the moon is receding from us. Is that data important at all to your work?
Neither of us work directly on this stage of the problem of the tidal evolution of the moon. Now the moon is moving at centimeters per year away from the Earth, and it actually increased its the rate that it's moving away geologically recently because of the arrangement of our continents. So the current tidal efficiency is a bit higher with our big Pacific basin, and so the moon is moving away a little faster. Most of the constraints for understanding the origin of the Earth and Moon took place when the Moon was much closer, just in terms of understanding the implications for the event that made the Moon.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the formation of the Moon with Sarah Stewart and Simon Locke. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guests are UC Davis planetary scientist and MacArthur Grant winner Sarah Stewart, along with Simon Locke from Caltech. Both researchers have helped to develop a new twist on the giant impact theory for the formation of Earth's moon. What I'd like to ask you guys now is, like, if you were to be able to, in as concisely as you can, a new textbook coming out for perhaps, say, a high school earth science class explaining what our modern understanding is based on your work on the origin of the moon. Can you take us through, you know, what your understanding is, how you would give that to the general public? Take us through the process of how the moon actually formed based on your work.
So what I would say is that the basic principle is still the same. A body hit the Earth at late in its growth. But what is different is what happened to the proto-Earth during that process, or as a result of that process. Because what we proposed is, if the impact was high enough energy and it left the post-impact Earth with enough angular momentum, so left it spinning fast enough, you produce a new type of object that we call the synestia. And a synestias are huge. They can be many times the size of the present day Earth. The outer portions of them are made of vaporized rock, and they form a sort of donut, sort of filled donut shape. Body, sort of think of a filled donut and squish it in the center. And these things are so big that the moon actually forms inside the vapor of the synestia. It sort of forms inside the Earth. And over time, as the synestia cools, as it radiates to space, the whole thing shrinks back down to form the Earth and leaves the moon in orbit around the Earth. But that moon has basically been formed, it's been baked in the center of the synestia, and so acquires a lot of its very unique properties that couldn't be explained by other theories. And so what is primarily different is that instead of thinking about one giant impact, so the Mars mass body hitting the proto-Earth, you can actually have, there are a range of possible impacts that you can have that can actually produce a synestia that goes on to form our moon.
Sarah, what's
What I'd like you to do is explain this to, like, you know, a very smart sixth grader to where they could understand this.
That's right. It's I'll admit that parts of it are tricky. So we can talk about it in terms of what's different. What is different from the original model? The main thing we learned is that giant impacts can take a rocky planet and turn it into a new type of object. We named this object a synestia because it's something that violates the definition of a planet. It's too large to have a simple hydrostatic structure, and it extends into into a disk. And we learned that most giant impacts will make a synestia, so that they were common. And perhaps all of the rocky planets in our solar system were synestias at one point before they cooled back down and turned back into a normal planet. When a synestia forms, it will make a moon, or one or more, because of the principle of conservation of angular momentum. There will always be a moon that forms, whether or not it stays in orbit around that planet. And so there's this missing step from the old textbooks where they didn't know that synestias existed or what they were, and that moons could form within them. So that's the new view of making the moon, by making a synestia and making the moon inside the synestia.
And how much of that is based on your experiments that you've done at the lab?
So the experiments provided information about what was vapor and what was magma droplets in the system. So we could use that information from the lab to understand the chemical nature of the system, to make predictions about which elements would form in the magma and become part of the moon, and which elements would stay in the gas and end up as part of the Earth. Because we do see differences between the Earth and the moon in elements that we call volatile, that turn into a gas at relatively low temperatures. So those end up being the tests for our model, whether or not, as we continue to develop it, we can explain the details of the chemical differences between the Earth and the moon.
I think we all, as humans for millennia, you know, have all been inspired by watching the full moon rise over a hill where it looks so large and so beautiful, and it dominates our lives. It's part of our calendar. The phases of the moon are a big rhythm of our lives. I'm curious, for you as a scientist who studies this at such detail, when you go out and just, you know, look at the full moon rising, or a beautiful crescent moon in the early morning or early evening, what are some of the thoughts you have when you look at it?
I mean, I think it's just so cool that you can see another planetary body. And really, the thing that really hits me is it looks like something out of science fiction, and yet it is right there in the sky. I should say that me and the moon went through a rough patch in the middle of my PhD, where, you know, I'd be cycling home from the lab late at night, and it would be there taunting me, being like, oh, you can't understand me, I'm too complicated. But we're on much better terms now.
You've come to an understanding.
We have an agreement.
And Sarah?
So I regularly talk to the moon discuss with it aspects of its formation. And I like to picture it back in time. You know, going back in time, the moon is right next to us. It would have been enormous on the sky. And when I'm more philosophical, I like to think about the stage that we were really one object altogether, and that everything we know today everything we see around us came from that same object, came from an original source. And that's just an amazing aspect of nature to appreciate.
That's beautiful. And I also like the thought of thinking about you looking at the moon and asking it questions and pondering it and looking for the answers. Okay, well, before we let you go, what are some of the big questions you have moving forward with your research? Where do you go from here? What are some of the things that you want to understand? And are some of the new releases of data about the moon rocks that now that we have better instrumentation to study the Apollo samples that haven't even been studied yet, do any of those kinds of things inform you or get you interested in pursuing this further? What are some of the big questions for you moving forward about the moon?
The new measurements from the open samples will be very interesting to see what else is similar and what else is different between the Earth and Moon, because those are now the keys to testing the details of how to make the Moon. And making our understanding why the Moon is exactly the way it is tell us more about the physics of what happens during planet formation. I think in general, understanding that this new object forms, that a synestia forms, we should turn back to the Earth and try and understand why the Earth is the way it is, and are there features that we see today in the Earth that we can pin on processes that occurred during the formation of the Moon? Because there are many mysteries about the deep Earth and even why, you know, we have our habitable planet, that we can investigate, knowing that the origin of the Earth is different than what we thought it was. Mm.
Yes, I definitely agree. I think looking at how Earth evolved after the impact and sort of what this traumatic event and the traumatic events that led to up to this as well, because the Earth probably experienced more than one giant impact. It could have had more than one moon over its history. But understanding the effect of those very traumatic events on the Earth itself is very important. But I also want to start to look beyond the Earth and beyond our solar system to start to look at this huge array of planets that we've now discovered around other stars and actually look and see how many of those planets experience similar phases in their formation. And actually, it might be possible for us to catch one of those bodies still as a synestia around a young star or a planet or a system that has recently gone through some stage of instability where planets have ended up colliding. And I think to me, that would be incredibly exciting.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. It's interesting you mentioned that. That popped into my head thinking about the James Webb Space Telescope and our future instrumentation. It would be interesting to look to see if you could find these synestias around other stars.
And I think we can. I think if you saw one, they are distinctive enough that you would potentially know. One of the major ways that we find planets around other stars is to look at stars and see tiny dips in the amount of light we get from those stars as planets cross in front of them. Now, because synestias are so much bigger than the equivalent sort of rocky planet would be, and they are very different shapes because they're sort of elongated, these sort of squished donut shapes, the shape of what we call the light curve. So the light we receive from the star over time looks very different if you're a synestia or you're just a spherical planet. And I think it might be that we've already seen one and we've just ignored it because it looks too different. Or it could be that in the next generation of telescopes and data analysis, we might actually be able to pick one of those bodies out of the data and then start to follow up with more telescopes and try and really double check ourselves and see whether it is actually a post-impact body, a synestia, or not.
Well, finally, and this has been fascinating, thinking about these other planets around other stars and our own planetary system, which has such diversity to it, you know, there's this huge amount of discussion going on between different groups of scientists. I'd like to get your take on, you know, what is a planet to you?
What is a planet? Right? I am okay with the definition by the International Astronomical Union. Our technical definition of a body in orbit around a star, clearing its zone, and having a hydrostatic shape. It actually ended up being very useful to explain the key difference with the synestia. You know, when a planet can be a spheroid, you can calculate the interior pressure, density, temperatures. And it's a fixed number. It's what we call static. But when a body becomes a synestia, it violates that distinction, that definition of a planet, and there's not a fixed structure. It's an object that's always changing, spreading with time and cooling and dynamically evolving. And so it is a key difference that there's a dynamic object, a transient object, versus a stable object that we think of as a planet.
And the reason I ask that is that it almost does seem like the moon is like a double planet with the Earth.
If the moon were not orbiting the Earth and were just orbiting the sun, it would, by itself, it would qualify as a planet, yes.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it just seems like the Earth is really, to look at the Earth-Moon system, it seems to me like that's a double planet system.
That is a perfectly reasonable way to think about it, yes.
Yeah.
Finally, if you could perhaps target a place on the moon, are there any regions of the moon you'd like to see us get samples from that would be most interesting to you?
Yes. The Apollo missions all went to a sort of very narrow region of the surface and all on the side facing that sort of consistently faces us. What would be very exciting is to go back and find samples from the far side, so the side that we never see from the Earth. And specifically, there is a very large impact basin.
Tsiolkovsky.
No.
Oh, South Aitken.
South Aitken Basin.
Yeah, okay.
And there is a suggestion, and recently from the Chang'e mission from the Chinese Space Agency, that maybe that impact was big enough that it excavated below the lunar crust and actually brought up some chunks of the lunar mantle. Ooh. And if we can find and bring back one of those chunks of the lunar mantle, it would really help our understanding of the moon. Because all of the rocks we have so far are things that are at the surface. They're crustal material. And to have generated them, they've had to go through a process of melting. They've had to go and differentiation. So in order to infer things about the moon, you sort of have to remove that filter that those samples, those rocks have gone through. But if you could get a sample of the mantle itself, it would probably throw up way more questions than it answered, but it would remove the need to sort of take off that filter, and you can actually look at the interior of the moon sort of uncorrupted.
Ah, and that's in the south polar region of the moon, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's the largest impact basin that's been confirmed on the moon. It's probably one of the oldest as well.
And would you also want samples from, and you'd also want samples from the far side?
So South Pelican Basin is on the far side, but there are also what we call the lunar highlands, so the sort of white bits as you look at the moon. So the far side of the moon is mostly covered by that type of rock, and it would be very interesting also to get a sample of the highlands from the far side to see how they compare to the samples that we have from the near side as well.
That's interesting. Well, it's been fascinating talking to both of you. Briefly, before I let you go, what's your favorite part of your work?
The thinking, and play a movie in your mind and try and work out different bits of it and how you can answer those different bits. And then being able to go away and use the wonders that is physics and chemistry and actually test that movie in your brain. And I think that's a really fun, just to be able to sit there with your, it's not quite Sherlock Holmes, I don't smoke three pipes, but the equivalent, and just sit there, you know, with sort of a box of chocolates and a beer and really sort of think through a very deep problem.
Yes, quite a three-pipe problem.
Yeah, exactly. And I get to claim that's work, which is great.
I mean, there are real discovery moments, these eureka moments. They're very satisfying, but it really, explaining nature to our satisfaction, right? To say, I get it. I get what's happened. And now today we can explain it better than yesterday. That is really very satisfying.
And I think there's also one of the huge advantages of the field in which we work is the fact that we get to do things like this. People share a real fascination with the planets, with the universe around us. And actually to go and talk to people and be able to say, look, here's something new. As Sarah said, like, this is something we didn't understand before. That's really cool. And people really want to learn about that. And I feel that's very, very inspiring and very gratifying to sort of have that contact with people outside the world of academia.
Well, I want to thank you both, Simon Locke and Sarah Stewart, for joining us to tell us about the origin theory of the moon and your work on it, because it's really, really fascinating to me, and I know it will be for our listeners, and it just makes me want to go out and go look at the moon in a whole new way next time I go outside.
Everybody should look up and appreciate it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've always loved looking at the moon, and it's, you know, one of the first things I looked at through a telescope as a child, because I lived in Los Angeles and, you know, you couldn't see a whole lot, but, you know, the moon was right. The moon was really cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. This has been fun.
Thanks again to our guests, planetary scientist Sarah Stewart from the University of California at Davis and Simon Locke from Caltech. I know next time I look at the moon, I'll think about what a synestia, containing both the newly forming double planets that would become the Earth-Moon system, might have looked like from deep space billions of years ago. It certainly wouldn't have been a pale blue dot with a rocky companion back then. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.